6.5 minutes after 10 o'clock. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, according to my guest this hour, even in hard times, shopping continues to be a true national pastime in America. We'll talk about a book about this fact titled Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. The author is Lee Eisenberg. Eisenberg spent nearly 20 years as editor-in-chief for Esquire magazine. He was also an editorial consultant for Time magazine. He served as executive vice president at Land's End, and I intend to ask him about his time there because it was pretty interesting. He was there during the transition when Land's End became an acquisition of Sears. And he's also a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania. What he is right now is unavailable to us by phone, so we hope to have Lee Eisenberg on in just a moment. His other books, in addition to Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What, include The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life. And we expect he's on. Okay, we've got him. Good morning, Mr. Eisenberg, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us. Okay, Shoptimism is a really cool title, but what does it mean?
Well, it means what the subtitle says, which is why we will keep on buying no matter what, be they good times or bad times. That's not to say that we will keep on buying the same way or the same things or at the same places, but it does mean that where there's a will to shop, there's a way to shop, and for better or worse, we Americans will find it.
You know, I've had similar discussions to the one I'm anticipating we'll have in a way this hour with people, and I want to go to this right away. I mean, traditionally, America was thought of, you know, the tradition of the Puritans who came over and, you know, Plymouth Rock and the whole thing, frugality and conservatism in all things like, you know, moderation, not doing too much, not spending more than you have, all of that stuff. That seemed to be a real American tradition. All of a sudden, at some point, somebody threw a switch and we just said, weapons free, we're just going to go out and buy everything. Where did we make this switch and why do you think that happened?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very, very good question, and I try to deal with it in the book. You're absolutely right that, well, first of all, that switch was thrown not 10 years ago or 20 years ago or even 50 years ago, but quite a long time ago. Yes, the American ethos, if you will, was founded on all the things you mentioned, you know, waste not, want not. And it was basically built around the idea that resources are scarce, including financial resources, and that the righteous life was a life that was led through frugality and rational buying and all the rest. That really began to change in the early part of the 20th century, around about, you know, 1900, give or take. And what drove the beginning of the change was the Industrial Revolution, that suddenly the world was making all kinds of things on a mass basis, and goods were flowing all over the world, including into the United States, at a rate that we had never seen before in history. And at the same time, industrialization was providing jobs for millions of people, factory jobs, people who would suddenly enjoy a weekly paycheck. So those two sort of global forces came together, and retailers, or the sell side, as I call it throughout the book, was very quick to perceive that they had just an almost boundless opportunity, and that was around the time these, you know, incredible department stores that had only been in Europe up to that point, you know, in Paris or London, began to sprout up in New York and Chicago and other major cities. And they weren't just department stores; they were palazzos. You know, they were these extraordinarily ornate and beautiful and huge buildings that had chandeliers and skylights and floor walkers who wore white gloves and so on and so forth. And working men and women, for the very first time, people who had been accustomed to shopping out of push carts suddenly found themselves in these unbelievable emporia, and they had some money to spend. So I think what then had to happen is we had to, and to get back to your question directly, what then had to happen is we sort of had to rewire the American character, as I put it in the book. How do you move from a culture that was built on frugality and scarcity and turn it into a culture that condoned or even wildly encouraged consumption? And all kinds of things were done to encourage that by the so-called sell side. Advertisements started to run that for the very, very first time talked about why buying was good for you, was emotionally satisfying. Not just things you need, but things you want. There was a whole therapeutic, ethos in terms of how things were marketed. Even cigarettes, eventually. If you remember back in the 50s and before that, you had all these ads in magazines that featured doctors who were openly talking about their choice in cigarettes. That being an extreme example. But this idea that buying is good for you, that buying is pleasurable, that buying brings relaxation, that buying brings style, and all the rest were really themes that began, a good 100-plus years ago. And then as the country got more and more prosperous, the advertisements got more and more ubiquitous and louder, and then suddenly we were in a society in which buying was not only accepted, but really the linchpin, frankly, of the economy. And just to add one more note here, where that really took on a sort of a catalytic effect was back in the 50s, post-war, the great boom, the prosperity, the golden era of consumption, the beginning of consumption. And there's a terrific book written by a historian named Elizabeth Cohen called Consumer's Republic, and what she argues there is that in the 50s, we made the transition pretty fully from what had been citizenship, to be a citizen of America was to be patriotic, into a country where consumership was basically the mark of the patriotic person, that buying was good for the country, and what was good for business was good for America. And that pretty much sealed the deal and took us, at an accelerated rate pretty much up to the last couple of years when, of course, the economy took a dramatic turn in the other direction.
Well, I mean, it's one thing. I understand to the point where you, after World War II, you had a significant rise over a couple of decades in real wages. People were becoming more and more prosperous, and so they had more available money to spend on things like houses, like cars, dishwashers and washing machines and all sorts of other labor-saving devices and clothing and things like that. But real wages have stagnated over the last three decades, and yet Americans have become the biggest retail consumers anywhere, most of that on credit. Where did we, where did it become?
I was going to say, absolutely, it's called the credit card. And it's called easy credit, and it's called all of those toxic mortgages that came into the market. Without all of that, of course, we might well have lived better within our means. But with the advent of easy credit, and we've all heard stories, over the last couple decades of dogs getting credit card applications in the mail by mistake. That was really the torch, that lit the bonfire that led to the excesses and personal debt, and eventually, to some significant degree, part of the problem that we're now living in, that happened in the housing world.
Was there some precipitating event that caused you to write this book? I mean, what was it that you noticed and you said, "Aha! There's a book here to be written."
Well, you mentioned my previous book in your intro. It was a book called The Number, which was published in 2006. And what that referred to was, it kind of seems slightly quaint now, but I began to get very intrigued a number of years ago about how people were avoiding, like the plague, any thought about how they were going to finance the second half of their life, retirement in particular, why they weren't saving, why they were procrastinating, you know, why they weren't getting a financial plan together. The book came out in 2006, virtually on the same day that the baby boom started turning 60. And it got a lot of attention, and I'm not saying the book is responsible for this, but in that year and then the year after that, suddenly the whole financial services industry seemed to be alerted to the fact that that it was very, very important to start selling retirement plans and financial plans in general. So when the book came out and I went around the country talking about it and finally came back and talked to my publisher, he said, you know, one of the reasons, obviously, that people aren't saving is because they're spending like crazy. You know, this was sort of the end of 2006. Why not, as your next project, really sort of take on the flip side, which is, you know, we're not saving, we're spending. Why are we spending? You know, what is it, you know, to go back to your question, what is embedded in our character that's making us do this? And then how is that aided and abetted by this enormous the thing that I call the sell side, which is, you know, the whole retail universe, consumer research of every kind, neuroscientists who are studying the brain to find out what makes us buy, advertising agencies, marketing consultants, and all the rest. How does all of that kind of work? So the aha moment, if you will, was the idea that I would take this journey through both sides of the equation. First, through the sell side, and that's the first part of the book. It's called Them Versus You, How It All Works. And then the second part of the book is called You Versus You, which is what is it that goes on, you know, between our ears that makes us either willing participants or in some ways, I hesitate to use the word victims because I don't think there's a true conspiracy afoot, but what is it that makes us susceptible to marketing and advertising? So it wasn't exactly one moment. It was really an outgrowth out of why we're not saving.
We're talking about the book Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. We have the author of that book, Lee Eisenberg, who is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Number. He's with us to talk about this. It's a fascinating subject. We're really happy that we were able to get Mr. Eisenberg for the show, and wondering what you think. What about your own shopping habits? Call in and talk about it. And, you know, I mean, did you notice this explosion in retail that started really probably in the 80s and the 90s? I mean, where we were building mall after mall and all of these shops were opening up. And I personally was wondered, who's buying all this stuff? And then I realized it was me. But we're talking about that and wondering what you think. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number you can use to join our conversation, 800-642-1234. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back with more with Lee Eisenberg and your calls. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. After 3 o'clock on Here on Earth, more and more people are learning Arabic these days. After 3 on Here on Earth, Gene Faraca talks with the authors of the most popular Arabic textbook in the world, who insist that the language is not all that hard to learn after all. That's coming up after 3 today with Gene Faraca here on Earth. This hour, it's Kathleen Dunn's program. John Munson sitting in for Kathleen today. And we're talking about the new book, Shoptimism. Lee Eisenberg wrote this book. It's Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What, published by Free Press. And he joins us by phone, and you can too at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Before we go to the phones, I do one more question off my list here. Given the present economic circumstance, I mean, high unemployment, tight credit, collapsing real estate values, why will we keep on buying and how will we manage to do it?
Well, we're having a difficult time doing it. And how we're doing it is by not shopping in certain places for certain things and instead shopping in other places for other things. You know, I do think there's a little bit of a recovery going on now, but this is not going to be, obviously, for all the reasons you mentioned, this is not going to be a banner year for retail. Last year, in fact, was the first negative drop in holiday sales in memory. And we'll be lucky if we match it this year, or if we exceed it, it'll be only by a little bit. But I think what is happening right now is, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show this idea that's ingrained in our character, which is, you know, frugality or carefulness or whatever. And I think what we're seeing now, because of the chaos and the tragedy of the economic conditions we've been living under, I think we're seeing, if not a reversion back into that frugality, I think we're going to come out of this a little bit more balanced than we were. You know, in the book, I talk about two kinds of shoppers, and I think most of us fall on this spectrum somewhere between the two. On the one hand, you have what I call classic shoppers, and those are buyers who are very rational, who think a lot about value, who think about practicality and quality and durability and bang for the buck and all the rest, who are not given to splurging on features and benefits and extra buttons and all the rest on a whole variety of products. They basically buy what they believe they need and are therefore not very excessive. They're not necessarily cheapskates, although many of them, you know, are tight, but I'm not referring to cheapskates specifically. On the other end of the spectrum, you have what I call the romantic buyer, and the romantic buyer has been really the buyer that's been predominant over the last several decades, and that's somebody who does buy a bit more on impulse, who buys emotionally, somebody who buys with his or her heart, as opposed to the classic buyer who buys with his or her head. They're susceptible to the new and different. There's a tremendous fascination with novelty. There's a tremendous fascination with trends and, you know, being fashion right and so on and so forth. And that person does buy a lot of features and buttons and switches and things that they never quite learn how to use, but they nonetheless buy them anyway. So if you think about, you know, buying temperaments on as a kind of spectrum, you have the classic on the left and the romantic on the right. What the economic situation has forced us to do is to, I think, gain a bit more equilibrium. And, you know, I've been asked a lot of times, well, you know, when the economy recovers, are we going to go back to our profligate ways? And I don't think we will all the way, because I think this has been a very sobering and even though a very tragic couple of years, I do think there might be some silver lining to it, which is to say that we have now become much more mindful about what to spend on, and far less less than we were. So what you're seeing today is that, you know, the high-end, you know, luxury stores are having a very difficult time. The traditional department stores are having a very difficult time. But the discounters are sort of keeping their heads above water. And, you know, I ran into a conversation not long ago, just a few weeks ago, in which a woman said that she had been a lifetime thrift shop shopper. She just liked doing it. She wasn't particularly poor, but that's where she always enjoyed buying her clothes and liked it. And she was complaining that there are so many more people, not just people who are out of work, but people who still have quite a lot of money who are shopping at thrift shops. And she was complaining that the prices at Goodwill were going up as a result. You know, and I think that's an example of you know, if nothing else, of how resourceful we are. You know, we're going to find something to buy someplace at a price we can afford. And it's also an example, I think, of the culture saying, you know what, it's even if you can't afford something, it's sort of cool not to run around, you know, head to toe in designer labels, but to actually go off and, you know, maybe buy something that's relatively expensive here, but complement it with something, you know, that is a thing that's a true bargain. So I think this idea, this sort of living in luxury or conspicuous consumption or whatever we were under, generally speaking, around the country several years ago, is now decidedly out of fashion. And I'm not sure it's going to come back anytime soon. It, you know, if you talk to the super premium luxury designer marketers, they don't really see their growth anymore in the United States. Where they see their growth is in places around the world where, you know, quote, the money is young, you know, where there's a rising middle class, the so-called BRIC nations, as they're called, Brazil, Russia, India, China, places like that. That's where Louis Vuitton and Chanel and all the rest are going to grow, if they are going to grow. And I think they really see, both for economic and cultural reasons, that the U.S. is not going to be quite so receptive to just spending money mindlessly the way we have.
Well, it seems like the economic growth that we experienced in starting in the 80s and then into the 90s and into this decade was primarily fueled by people, corporations, and countries living beyond their means. If we all start living within our means, what happens to the economy?
Well, that's the underbelly, the ugly underbelly of all of this. The economy will continue to grow. It's just not going to grow in the overheated way that, you know, that it did. But that's a real question, you know, and that's one of the, you know, issues that, you know, an anti-consumerist, a really strong, willed and passionate anti-consumerist, you know, will make the case that, you know, there's nothing but evil and lack of character and all the rest in an overheated consumer economy, but at the same time, consumption, you know, represents something like 80% of the gross domestic product of the United States. So you can't have it all, basically. And we're going to find out what it feels like when the consumer is not so much the king in the years ahead.
Well, I've got about 3 pages of questions here, but we better get to some calls. Let's go to Josh in Madison first. Josh, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question for the for your guest. I was a teenager in the 90s, and I really saw what I believed was the growth of everything as collectible, the Beanie Babies, the Hot Wheels, and now everybody has a closet full of trinkets that are worth nothing that soccer moms thought they were going to retire on one day, and just wondering if he has anything to comment on that.
Yeah, well, I do, and you know, it's interesting you say soccer moms thought they were going to retire, and I think a lot of them did. That stands in direct contrast to what it was like when I was sort of a formative consumer, which was, you know, a couple of decades before the decades you mentioned. And those were the days where moms were reviled for throwing out their kids' baseball card collection, including, you know, in my own case. But you're right. There seemed to be this cultural trend that somehow if you had enough Beanie Babies, you were going to feather your retirement nest in grand style. I don't think that's out there right now. The other thing about collecting, which I think is really interesting, you know, we walk around and sort of assume, or the media often tells us that we are or were a nation of so-called shopaholics. I reject that. Clearly, way too many people overspend and get themselves into trouble by over-leveraging themselves. But the actual incidence of shopaholism or compulsive buying, which is what social scientists call it, and have a very clear definition for it, is really in the single digits here in the United States. But what a study last year showed, one of the major studies that have ever been done on compulsive buying, it showed that there are proportionately about as many men who are certifiably compulsive buyers as there are women. And yet women have taken the rap for this for the most part. And a lot of men will qualify, but when you accuse them or suggest to them that they are indeed out of control compulsive buyers, they will say, no, I'm not a compulsive buyer, I'm a collector. And a lot of men, you know, sort of hide behind the nobility of collecting, not Beanie Babies, but, you know, fishing lures or digital cameras or, you know, whatever it might be. In fact, one of the psychiatrists who was a lead author on the study that I referred to actually told me of a case in which one of his patients who had come to him for help had a collection of something like 150 or 200 digital cameras, and this man virtually never took a photograph. So, you know, I think the collecting dodge is often a mask for excusing ourselves for excessive buying. I don't think Beanie Babies necessarily were bought shopaholically, but I'm sure in some cases perhaps they were.
Well, but, I mean, the access to easy credit, which really kind of took off in the 90s, 80s and 90s, made it a lot easier to get to yes. I mean, you know, before, if you were going to make a purchase, you had to look and see how much money you had in your wallet or in your checkbook.
Absolutely.
And then you could make it a decision, do I have enough to get to payday? And if I do, okay, do I have enough left over to go buy whatever this is? And my mother's rule, and my mother's a genius with money. Banks should hire her to manage their stuff, but... you know, she always said, look, if you see something you think you want to buy, fine, go home and think about it for a couple of days. And if you still want to buy it and you've got the money, and go back, and if it's still there, then go ahead and buy it. Well, obviously, most of the time, if it's going to be an impulse buy, you will have forgotten all about it within 2 days and you won't end up spending your money. And here's one of the pieces of advice my mother gave me that I wish to God that I had taken. But,
we
had a whole generation of people who thought like that.
Yeah, if you talk to a behavioral economist, and I did talk to a number of them when I was writing this book, Optimism, they really see a true evil. One of them said, "Credit cards are quote evil," and he was not, you know, saying that as a rabid anti-consumerist at all. But what he was saying, and what he really believes, and I think is true, is that in his terms, credit cards, and this is a quote from him, anesthetize the pain of paying. You know, it basically takes away the discomfort and the anxiety of paying. And what a lot of scientists are trying to, neuroscientists working, you know, in consultation with behavioral economists, is that they're trying to find this link almost neurologically in the brain. You know, everybody's looking for this I button in the brain, and I don't think we're any close to finding that, although there have been books out that have suggested we are, and I don't believe that we are. But there is some evidence to suggest that parts of the brain do feel discomfort in certain people, and some of us, not all of us, at the prospect of a purchase. And what the credit card does is basically come along and remove that discomfort from even happening. And as a result, you know, we feel little or no constraints about whipping it out and buying something that that we don't necessarily really need, maybe don't even want, but are certainly willing to act impulsively.
Well, let's take a call from Steve in Monona, because I think he's talking about some of the same things that we were just discussing. Steve, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I would like an opinion on this. This upsets me to no end when I go into a store and they ring up my purchase and they ask me if I have their in-store credit card. And I say no. And then, of course, well, sign up and we'll save you 20% or whatever at the time. And why don't they just give me a couple percent off of my cash when I lay that down? But my wife's willing to play this game, and I don't play it, but I'd like a comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's actually an incredibly timely question. I just read yesterday, actually, that the Fed is making retailers very, very nervous because they are considering putting some much tighter regulation on a store's ability to do that. Now, and the reason is not one that you touched on, but it's a good reason, which is there is no credit check when a store says, you know, we'll take 20% off if you take out a credit card with us today and you pay for this purchase with that card. There's no credit check whatsoever. And I don't know, and I don't know if anybody knows, the percentage of how much, you know, over-indebtedness we've incurred because of that specific store credit card marketing ploy, But it's very hard to imagine how a store can continue to do that if the regulations call for the store to basically, you know, approve or not approve you at the cash register in terms of offering you that. You're not, you're certainly not going to carry around last year's tax returns. You're not going to, you know, hand them over to a cashier to say, look, I can afford it. So there is some movement afoot to put an end to that. The reason they do it, and the reason they don't necessarily just take off the percentage, which is what you would like them to do, is because when you do take out that card, a couple things happen. First of all, they're no longer giving 2 or 3 or 4% to MasterCard or American Express. They're saving that cost by you using their card. But the other reason they do it, and it's a very invaluable reason for the sell side, is that they are getting an email address from you. They're getting your address. They're basically identifying you as a customer, and they're going to have that data locked down in their own servers, and then they will use it not necessarily to invade your privacy, but to market time and again to you and to keep track very carefully of what your buying behavior and what your past purchases are. So there's a real premium to them, quite aside from immediate profit, to having you on their file. You know, you'll get emails possibly, you'll get catalogs, and so on and so forth. If there's a private sale, you'll be so informed. So there's a real tremendous amount of future profit, you know, lifetime profit is what they call it. In you, if you take out that card. So for that reason, principally, they're much more inclined to want to have you use their card than to use a different credit card or God forbid, paying cash.
Well, and they're offering two different kinds. I mean, there's one thing to get a card that's just good at that chain, but they're also offering actual credit cards through their own banks. I'll engage in a little inappropriate self-disclosure here for talk show hosts, but I went into a discount store to buy an iPod, and I had originally intended to pay cash for it, and I ended up walking out with what was essentially an iPod and a $10,000 loan. And when I got home, I wondered how that had happened. But it's pretty easy to do because, you know, if you're having a weak moment, anything can happen.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got full phone lines all of a sudden, and I want to get to some of these calls because our callers are coming up with some great questions. Let's go to Wild Rose and talk to Kurt next. Kurt, good morning.
Hi. One of the things that I came to a realization a while ago is that we've sort of become indentured servants in a way because we mortgage ourselves and, you know, get into debt so far that we are forced then to keep working far past retirement just to pay off all the debt that we've accumulated. And one of the best things I ever did was, you know, get rid of all my cars and my car loans, my mortgages paid down, and so on, and that's allowed my family to weather this downturn in the economy fairly well because we didn't have all of these monthly bills that we had to worry about paying.
Well, that's true. And, you know, you mentioned another part of it. Even if one is conscientious and doesn't or didn't overspend on things that one didn't really need, there are a lot more monthly costs today than there were, you know, 2 decades ago. You know, chances are you still have a landline. You almost certainly have a cell phone. You have to keep refilling your printer at home with ink cartridges. There's a cable bill that we didn't have once upon a time. There's just a ton of things that largely accrue to technological changes that have happened that are fundamentally, you know, you don't need them to live, but you'd have to be pretty, you know, you need email often for business reasons, if not, you know, personal reasons and so on and so forth. So, you know, life really, the monthly bill situation has really changed dramatically, certainly in the utility end of things. And those are things, and I do get into the book. There's a large, long discussion in the book about, you know, trying to kind of define what is a need versus what is a want. And, you know, obviously, if you want to be very literal about it, the only needs we have you know, are the obvious ones. You know, there's food and water and shelter and clothing, and you could argue health care. Health care.
Well, let's not go there.
Be getting filled in many instances.
Let's not go there.
And then everything else, by definition, is a want. But it then gets very, very dicey because, there are lots of quote-unquote wants out there that you effectively pretty much need. And then there are some wants that you really don't much need, but you can argue play a positive and very useful role in one's life. You know, I talk in the book about a guy who spent a ton of money on electric trains, on model trains. And his wife thinks he's a compulsive buyer of, semaphores and little plastic people and extra cars and all the rest. But if you go back to, Abraham Maslow, the great, the great psychologist who is notable for what he called the pyramid of needs, you could argue emotional needs. You could argue that a lot of that man's spending on model railroading actually plays a salutary role in his life. He gets enormous creative satisfaction. He gets a lot of respect from the kids in the neighborhood. He goes off to swap meets on the weekends and finds, true community among other model railway buffs and so on. So there's a lot of positive satisfaction that he gains from what many would see as a superfluous and kind of frivolous waste of money. So it gets very, very difficult and dicey to say what's a want and what's a need. And while the book is not a pro-consumer book at all, it is sort of an anti-consumer book, which is the fact that I don't know that the very radical anti-consumers have much right to tell that railway guy, that railroad buff, that he has no right having that collection. That's really something for him to decide and then make sure that his hobby or his passion doesn't bust the family budget.
Well, I've been trying to convince my wife for years that that I need an acoustic 12-string guitar and that would help me self-actualize, but so far...
Well, exactly, and I think...
That hasn't worked. Let's take another quick call before we go to a break. Go ahead.
No, we can go to the break and pick it up later if you like.
Well, I want to take one more call because I want to hear what Jenny in Menominee has to say to us this morning. Jenny, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm calling about the amount of seasonal and themed items that have just shown up in all the stores lately, especially big box stores, making you feel like, as a homeowner, you're doing something wrong if you don't just change out everything from hand towels and rugs and dishes and all the decor for everything from Valentine's Day to, obviously, Christmas, Easter, 4th of July, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I mean, there's something wrong with you if you don't have pink cookware and all the autumn harvest-themed stuff. And then the stores even go ahead and stock appropriately colored Rubbermaid bins for you to store all this stuff in. There are pastel ones in the springtime and orange and black ones in the fall. And it's just, you're just inundated with it when you walk in. And then a lot of this stuff ends up on the clearance racks the day after, and they're changing out to the next. It's just endless, the amount of stuff for as the seasons change. And it used to be people decorated their homes at Christmas time, perhaps, and now it's there's always a season. That, you can buy all these little adornments for.
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say that from the sell side, I mean, that's one of the ways that retailers have gotten us to keep shopping and buying things. They keep coming up with new things that we need to have. We need to have these seasonal decorating items and so forth, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely why they do it. Question lies, I think, though, is not why the sell side does it. We know why they do it. The question is, are we being manipulated by that? Are they injecting us with some sort of a ravaging buy virus that makes us buy, pink dinnerware for Breast Cancer Awareness Month? Or are we making that decision on our own? Just because it's in the store doesn't mean we need to buy it. Just because there's a decorative scheme for every, holiday, large and small, doesn't mean we have to buy it. And yet, I think as a culture, or at least a part of the culture, likes to blame the sell side for manipulating us into buying these things. And I'm sure the mere presence of them does encourage some of us to buy some of it. But I think we need to stop for a minute and actually give shoppers or buyers a little more credit, either positive credit or not so positive credit, for having a free will. And, you know, where I part company with some of the anti-consumer consumerists is that I really don't believe we are as manipulatable as they would have us to believe. You know, we're living in this incredibly over-retailed and over, obviously over-consumed society. Every scrap of vacant territory in real estate is covered over with an ad, and television is ads. There's no question that we are, you know, swimming in it the way fish swim in water. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need, that we are manipulated by it. And if we think we are, or if an individual thinks he or she is, then I would advise that person to really think through his or her own judgment and not be so quick to lay the blame off on marketers, advertisers, retailers, researchers, and everybody else who've got a vested interest in our buying stuff. And I think most of us understand the difference, just like that caller seemed to. I do think most of us are not sheep who are being led to some kind of inevitable slaughter by this diabolical sell side, even though I won't for a moment dispute that we're living in a world that has way too much marketing and advertising in it.
We're talking about the book Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. We have the author of that book, Lee Eisenberg, with us on the phone. Lines are now available for you if you'd like to call. 800-642-1234. Thanks, Jenny, for your call. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more callers and more questions for our guests. Stay with us. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10:49, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. This hour, we're talking about the book Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. But coming up later today on the Ideas Network, after 5, join the conversation as Ben Marins talks with Republican Mark Newman about his candidacy for governor of Wisconsin. That's on At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 o'clock today. This hour, we're having a really nice conversation with Lee Eisenberg, who is the author of Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What, published by Free Press. He spent nearly 20 years as editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine, was an editorial consultant for Time magazine, served as executive vice president at Land's End, is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and his other books include The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life. And Mr. Eisenberg, one of the things I wanted to ask you about really has nothing to do with your book, but I noted that you were at Land's End during the transition when they went basically from a catalog merchant to being part of the Sears empire, and I wanted to ask you about what that culture shift was like.
Yeah, well, it actually is part of my book. I don't write about it extensively, but I do refer to many of the things that I learned while working at Land's End. And I also do talk a bit about the difference in culture between Land's End when it was its own company and the Sears culture. I stayed on with Land's End for about a year or so, year and a half after the acquisition, because I wanted to help see it through and to make sure that Land's End was, you know, safely nestled in the arms of its new owner. And I'm laughing only because it was quite an experience. You can't imagine, I mean, they're both part of the sell side, obviously, but very, very different temperaments and cultural characteristics of these two companies. And I've lost touch, you know, I don't know how Land's End's doing, and I'm not sure what the cultural reading would be, you know, these days. But I found it very instructive, and there are parts in the book where I get into details about how Land's End went about its business when it had its own business model, and then what the contrasting business model and strategies and values were at Sears. And actually, it proved very valuable in giving me a perspective as to how to write other parts of the book.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Nathan in Green Bay next. Nathan, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick comment. Basically, how America seems to be the motto for bigger, better, faster, more. And I was just curious what your guest thinks about how television kind of confuses people into the need and the buy and the want. You know, more so. It basically confuses people. You know, watching television, all the ads, like you were talking about. You know, the need and the want, and how it kind of, I guess, turns people into little clones of Aruka Salt. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Yeah, well, again, I will not defend how cluttered and commercial television and frankly, every other medium is. I mean, you can't go to the movies now that you don't sit through, you know, 10 minutes of commercials, and then when the movie starts, you then sit through an hour and a half of product placements. You know, it's not an accident that James Bond is wearing the brand of watch he is or driving the car he is or anything else. So there's been this tremendous immersion of marketing and advertising in actual programming, television and everywhere else, and in magazine publishing, the once sacred, you know, line between church and state, you know, is very, very blurred these days. The question is that good for the culture? No. Does that make for a lot of vapid programming? Yes. Are we being fooled? That probably not. You know, I think what most of us have never known a culture in which the sell side advertising marketing hasn't been pervasive, and it's more pervasive today than it's ever been. That said, I don't think we take it quite as seriously, perhaps, as some people might believe. You know, we're so used to breathing it, we're so used to seeing it. You know, when you see the Coca-Cola cups on the desk of the judges on American Idol, I think most of us know how they got there, which is because Coke is paying for them to be there. So while I'm not saying that's a good thing or that we should just kind of, you know, accept it, we can turn off the set, we can get annoyed by it, but where I part company is that I don't think too many of us are getting fooled. But I do mourn the loss of, you know, if you will, independent content, because in virtually every medium, there is now this blurring between, you know, the so-called art or content and the commercial component.
Let's go to Diana in Madison next. Diana, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. And I'm actually going to disagree with your guest there. I'm just going to relate my personal experience and let you know that, you know, I stopped watching television. I got rid of my television about 7 years ago. And I didn't expect this to be the side effect, but I found that I had more money in my budget. And it just turned out, I eventually figured out, that I just don't buy stuff that I don't need anymore because I'm not exposed to advertising. And it's true, if it's out there, they're gonna find a way to make you want to need it somehow or other. You need that piece. Oh, look how convenient your life would be if you had this thing or that thing, or what a wonderful addition to your life this would be. And without that constant exposure, I just didn't buy anything because I didn't know I didn't need it anymore. So I just, you know, I don't know how else to say it, except that it really made a big difference in how I approached spending.
Well, you know, I certainly accept that. But as you say, they're going to find a way to get under your door. That doesn't mean you'll be vulnerable to it, but, you know, step outside or open your mailbox or go to the movies, as I just mentioned, or, you know, look up at a billboard or so on. It's out there.
Well,
now, maybe less exposure in an individual case such as yours will diminish. But I think for the greater number of people, I think most of us just simply have to be aware of are we being lulled into, we talked earlier about your mother's advice, you know, wait a couple of days. There are things I think we can do, at least some of us can try to do, to try to, you know, staunch the onslaught, particularly if we're susceptible. And the fact is, some of us are less susceptible by nature than others to advertising. So I don't question it at all, and if that's resulted in a happier, clearer head, and a better overall family budget, then terrific. I congratulate you.
Well, we live in a mediated society. I mean, you can't even go to the men's room without seeing advertising now. You know, you step up to the urinal, and here, right in front of your face, is a four-block ad thing telling you about almost anything you might want to even think of. So we're constantly bombarded with messages. Do you have a website that people can go to find out more about your book?
I do a blog every day. Frequently, every day, and or more than once a day. It's simply my name, Lee Eisenberg, LeeEisenberg, LeeEisenberg.com. And there are some excerpts from the book, and there is, as I said, a continuous blog. I like to keep a hand in here, and I do make it timely and newsy, picking up on many of the themes in the book itself.
Thank you very much for joining us and talking about your book this morning. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Lee Eisenberg, who spent nearly 20 years as editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine, editorial consultant for Time, and served as executive vice president at Land's End, joined us by phone. The title of the book, again, Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What, published by Free Press. Carmen Jackson produced this program. On-air production from Keisha Mabra and Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to them for helping make this another great hour here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.